From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm April Baer. Today, how Detroit's vaccination process is going.
I think it's really important to Detroiters that they see people who look like them getting the vaccine first, so then they can think about whether or not that's a decision that they also want to make.
Also, how the city leveraged help from a large and well-funded partner, Quicken Loans.
We built the system. We've got 80 folks manning the phones, and to date, we've scheduled almost 43,000 vaccination appointments at the TCF Center in downtown Detroit.
And today we talk with photographer Lenny Sinclair about her years of political involvement and her stunning photos of Detroit's stages and people.
Coming from another country, I have maybe a different outlook on what was happening in America because I looked at it with through foreign eyes.
Those stories coming up. Welcome to Stateside. I'm April Baer. On today's show, Detroit photographer Lenny Sinclair. She captured some of the most iconic images of musical greats, from Aretha Franklin to Jimi Hendrix. Her latest solo exhibition at MOCAD focuses on her work chronicling decades of social justice activism in the city.
You know, I was always looking for an interesting picture, for something that would be interesting to keep and to look at and remember what it was like.
More on that later in the show. But first, we wanted to look into how Detroit is doing with the vaccination process. There are many ways to think about this massive logistics effort. How many people have had doses? What percentage of the population do they represent? How efficient has the city been in getting the available doses to those in need? But according to several different metrics, Detroit has made some progress. Olivia Lewis is a reporter with Bridge Detroit, and she's reported several stories about vaccination in the city. She joins us now. Olivia, welcome to Stateside.
Hi, thanks for inviting me to be on the show today.
Detroit has been folding more and more groups into the eligible category. Most recently, adults 18 and up with certain disabilities, including Down syndrome and autism, were added in. Who all is now eligible for vaccination, and how does that compare with the statewide picture?
Right. Actually, there's a lot of different groups in Detroit that are now eligible, which is really good news, actually. At first, the city started with 75 and up, then it went to 68. Now it's at 65. The city also implemented something that I thought was really cool, but a good neighbor program, whereas if you took someone with you who was an older adult, then you could also qualify to get the vaccine. Teachers, daycare workers, police officers, anyone working in the food and beverage industry, so that would include restaurant workers, grocery workers. There are a ton of people who are eligible right now to get the vaccine.
There's been a real focus at the state level and within the city about ensuring equitable access to vaccine, meaning to say, making some consideration for people who have been at greater risk for COVID up to this point. It's been a devastating year in Black communities and in Latino communities. I want to play a bite from the state's chief medical executive, Dr. Joanne Caldoun. Here's what she recently said about it.
I think more and more it's going to be important for us to really address our vaccination strategy from a lens of equity. We know that across the entire country, minority populations are not getting vaccinated at the rates of whites across the country. And we have to be strategic and targeted, not only in the way that we allocate our vaccines, but on the ground, the strategies we are implementing to get into neighborhoods to be able to vaccinate individuals.
So how do you see that having played out in Detroit so far?
Yeah, it's interesting. So the city and the state hasn't done this either, but neither entity has actually released official data on who from a demographic standard is receiving the vaccine, which is a little bit frustrating since there was such a big push earlier in the pandemic about racial health disparities. And so in Detroit, they've given us some preliminary data, which is about 70%, but the city doesn't require anyone to share that information. And so the data is already going to be a little bit skewed. But also something to think about is that, you know, this is information that they're trying to capture day by day, you know, and so it's really unclear to us who's getting the vaccine on a daily basis and week by week. So Bridge Detroit actually filed a FOIA request last week to try to better understand what that weekly data looks like. And we haven't gotten the results of that request yet. It's in process. As you know, FOIA requests can take a little bit of time to get what you're looking for.
Like months?
Right. Hopefully it won't take months. We've already received a response saying that the city received our request. But we're hoping to be able to take this information to really learn on a weekly basis, you know, who received the vaccine and who's not receiving the vaccine, so that we can really learn from this to understand, okay, like who's not being reached and where do the gaps exist?
Mm-hmm. I mean, I find it difficult to necessarily know which ball to keep my eye on. We might look at the city's overall success in terms of overall vaccination rate. We might look at it in terms of how quickly the city is able to get this limited number of available doses out to people who are eligible for it. How have you been thinking about this?
Oh my goodness. At Bridge Detroit, we're really just trying to figure out what information are Detroiters looking for? You know, what's most important to the people who live here? What questions do they have and how can we answer them as quickly as possible? And so a lot of the questions have been, how do I even get the vaccine? You know, what number do I need to call? Should I trust the vaccine? And, you know, that's something that we can't answer for Detroiters, but we can look to experts and say, what can you share about the vaccine? You know, a lot of the information that's been put out is really pointed toward the messaging. You know, that's so important for Detroiters who, and Black and brown people in general, who have had a lack of access, lack of trust, and just long-term systems that have really affected these populations in different ways and in a negative way. And so they want more information on just like, what happens to people when they get the vaccine? How do I sign up for it? If I sign up for it, you know, how much time is it going to take? Those are the kinds of questions that people are asking. And they want to know, well, did my neighbor get the vaccine? You know, and if my neighbor who looks like me got it, you know, how are they doing now? So it's things like that we're trying to answer at Bridge Detroit.
What kinds of things has the city been doing to try to reach people who may not be checking their email every day or who might not even have an email address, but who are definitely vulnerable for COVID?
Right. So the city has been having weekly press conferences. Mayor Mike Duggan usually leads those at the beginning of the week. There's been a lot of information sent out on social media. You can always check in on Facebook. But also we've seen a lot of photos on social media, especially like Twitter, of city officials like the health officer, Denise Fair, who there's a photo of her getting the vaccine in December. And so I think it's really important to Detroiters that they see people who look like them getting the vaccine first, so then they can think about whether or not that's a decision that they also want to make.
You know, the past year has just been so exhausting, really, for everyone in Michigan, but especially in Detroit. There's this layer of loss in the community. For all the people who died because of COVID already, all the families who've lost. I wonder if you have a sense from your reporting about how that affects the lens through which people see the vaccine. I believe I've read some coverage of people, you know, who have lost folks in their families to COVID, but they may still have some questions. They may still not be ready. Do you have any feel for how that layers into people's thinking as they're trying to make their decisions about this?
Yeah, for sure. I actually ran into someone yesterday who still had a lot of questions and was still very hesitant toward getting the vaccine, and they're actually working in the school system. And so I think that there is still a lot of outreach, a lot of learning that needs to happen to make people feel comfortable. And I think that knowing how many people that we've lost, so many family members, so many coworkers, confidants, anyone in the community, like we've just lost so many people where it's still like weighing on your heart that it makes it really difficult to make this decision to say, well, is this something that I should be putting into my body when we still don't really know everything there is to know about this disease? We don't know about this virus. So yeah, I think people are still definitely feeling that and trying to make a decision.
What do you see as some of the biggest challenges that the city might be dealing with moving forward? There's still a lot more people who are going to become eligible for shots.
Right. I think the city, even though they say that they are expecting more and more vaccines and that by summer we will be somewhat back to normal, and I hate the term back to normal because I don't think things will be exactly the same ever again. But, you know, the city says that they're going to get more vaccines. And I think the ongoing education and outreach is going to be, needs to be significant over the next few months. But also when that new normal arrives, what is that going to look like in the city of Detroit? And how do we think about some of the racial, health, and economic barriers that existed that really pushed the virus so far in Detroit early on? You know, like how can we change things from a systemic level so that this doesn't happen again? And so I think that's going to be the bigger question later on this year, and one of the things that we're really going to have to confront as a community. All of the leaders in our community are going to really need to push this and continue asking that question so that we don't make these same mistakes again.
So have you talked to anyone who wasn't quite sure about the vaccine but went and got it, and how they felt about it afterward?
So I actually told my grandparents to get the vaccine. And I will only use them as the example because they're my, they're my people. I don't want to put anyone else's business out there, I guess, without their permission. But I convinced my grandparents to go and get the vaccine because I thought it was important. Just because of their age, their health conditions, I told them, hey, it's available to you. Here's the information that I know. So if you want to ride, we will find a way for you to get there so that you can get the vaccine. And so far, they haven't had any troubles. They've been perfectly fine. But again, I think it's really up to everyone to make their own decision about whether or not to get the vaccine.
So your grandparents, they're feeling all right about it now, having done the deed?
Yeah, they are. They are definitely feeling a bit better.
Well, Olivia, we wish the best for your grandparents and your whole family. Thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Olivia Lewis is a reporter with Bridge Detroit. The city of Detroit was not alone in its vaccination campaign. It got a major assist from one of the largest businesses in town.
You know, our first call was to the mayor, how can we help?
In a moment, how Quicken Loans helped Detroit tackle the logistical challenges of the vaccine. That's next. Stick with us. This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. One of the reasons Detroit's vaccination operation seems to be going smoothly is because the city has a corporate partner with a vested interest in getting the city back to normal as quickly as possible. Quicken Loans, the behemoth of massive employment in downtown Detroit, founded by developer Dan Gilbert. With us today to talk about Quicken's interest in partnering with the city on vaccinations is the company's VP of Government Affairs, Jared Fleischer. Jared, welcome to Stateside.
It's great to be on. Thanks for having me.
So can you tell us about the partnership with the city of Detroit for vaccine administration? How did Quicken get involved?
This partnership actually goes back to March, right at the beginning of the pandemic. Our CEO, Jay Farner, reached out to Mayor Duggan and said, how can we help, Mr. Mayor? And the mayor said, you guys have thousands of people that answer phones. You guys know how to build technology. Most important thing we need to do right now is get Detroiters tested. Can you help? And we did. On a pro bono basis, we put together a strike team that worked around the clock for a couple of weeks through the weekends, building very complicated scheduling technology and data flow to set up what was then the big testing site at the state fairgrounds. And we ran that operation with the city for months and months. It's still going now. I'm not at the state fairgrounds, but we're still doing the testing side of things. Then obviously, once the vaccines were developed, we had the same conversation with the mayor. How can we help? And he said, let's do it all over again. So we built an adapted scheduling system, a little bit different when it comes to vaccinations, because there's different ways that you can be eligible, right? Either as a senior citizen or as a critical worker. and we need different kinds of information. But we built the system. We've got about 80 folks manning the phones, and to date, we've scheduled almost 43,000 vaccination appointments at the TCF Center in downtown Detroit.
Is there, I think when people think about the nature of Quicken's business, I mean, there are a number of white collar jobs that can be done over the phone. Is it an essential piece of day-to-day operations to have people healthy and able to come to work?
There's no question that it is. And we look forward to future phases of the vaccine rollout that will enable more and more of our employees to come back to the office. We think that's an important thing for our folks as humans, for their mental health. I think a lot of folks think they could be more productive if they're back in the office with their teammates. We think it's critical for the city of Detroit to have our thousands of team members back in the office, supporting all the small businesses that are downtown around our office space. We're still probably a little bit of a ways from the vaccination process opening up to office workers like that. Right now it's focused on really the most vulnerable, our senior citizens and other frontline workers who have no choice but to be working on the ground, be it at a grocery store or critical health worker. So that's the focus now. We're making good progress here in the city in vaccinating those populations. And we look forward to seeing it expanded further.
There were a number of different logistical pieces to this. What did the city and Quicken prioritize first for organizing?
Most important thing was to make this accessible to Detroiters. So we thought about, do we build a website to do this? And with the mayor's, guidance, really the answer was no. We need to have a call center because a lot of Detroiters, we do have an issue in Detroit with the digital divide. So the focus was how can we make this as convenient and as accessible as possible for Detroiters? That's why we built that's why we operated it through the call center and built all the technology to be able to take the information over the phone and send it everywhere that it needs to go to run a successful operation.
How has the partnership made for a different experience in Detroit than in some of the other cities and counties throughout the state where the primary engine might be a hospital or it might be the county health department?
Right. There's, I think, two critically important points. The first is, the hospital systems are great actors. But what we have seen is that disadvantaged populations who are often disconnected from health systems are having less success in getting vaccinated through health systems. And it's not because health systems are by any means turning them away, but disadvantage and communities who are more disconnected are having a hard time knowing about and navigating those processes. So what we're doing here in the city is it's really directed, towards Detroit residents who may not have those other resources, a PR campaign, outreach, and a daily effort led by the mayor himself to make sure Detroiters are aware of what we're doing, and really having an operation that is dedicated to Detroiters who may not otherwise be able to access this through other avenues. And then the mayor has said many times, and he's absolutely right, that we have some advantages here in Detroit in doing this and doing this at scale. We have a facility like the TCF Center, the Regional Convention Center. The mayor has a committed partner in Quicken Loans and Rocket Mortgage and Rock Connections. Those are all our entities that can do the technology and the call center at scale, with 80 people working on it every day, just on the call center side, another dozen or so on the technology side. So the need combined with the unique assets we have here, I'm added up to, I think, one of the most substantial and best run efforts anywhere in the country.
The rollout hasn't been particularly smooth anywhere in the United States, really. Maybe that's not surprising, given the scarcity of vaccine doses at this stage of the game. But do you think that there are some lessons to be learned about what happens when corporate support is in harmony with city administration for a public good?
Yeah, I think there's many lessons here about what positive corporate citizens can do. from the extraordinary efforts by, you know, Pfizer and Moderna to develop the vaccines in partnership with the federal government, that partnership all the way down to the kind of partnership you're seeing here between the Rocket family companies and the city, definitely shows what public-private partnerships can do.
You know, there are communities that don't have corporate citizens on the scale of Quicken to help organize and implement on a mass scale. Do you think there's something here that could scale down at a smaller level?
Absolutely. And not only do we think that, but we want to support that. So, for example, when we launched the testing site, we open sourced the software and we open sourced a very, very detailed playbook. So any community in Michigan or the United States could take it and replicate it without having to figure out, you know, all the hard, you know, coding work and logistical steps on their own. And we absolutely believe that this can be replicated even at a smaller scale. The technology has been developed. It's plug and play since we developed it. And you just need folks to implement it. And you can do that at a small scale.
Jared Fleischer is a VP for Government Affairs for Quicken Loans. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Take care.
When Leni Sinclair came to the United States from East Germany, she wasn't even out of her teens. Growing up in the Eastern Bloc in the years after World War II had given her a hunger to visit new places, to find some kind of freedom, and to see new things. She fell into one of the most dynamic periods of American history, Detroit in the 1960s and 70s. The places and people that she saw and photographed during that time are a capsule of those years. A new exhibition on view at the Museum of Contemporary Art Detroit, called Motor City Underground, is a chance to see some rarely viewed images Leni Sinclair took in that period, including from famous faces on stage to the passionate protests that shook the nation. Sinclair was politically active at the Detroit Artists Workshop and within the White Panther Party, both of which she co-founded with her then-husband, John. She's with us today to talk about her life and work. Leni Sinclair, welcome to Stateside.
Well, hello, everybody who's listening.
You know, I think people associate your work and your life with this time in America when Detroit pretty much invented what was cool. And yet, you're someone who grew up in East Germany in this post-war period when people were just barely getting by. When you were growing up, what passed for cool?
Anything coming from the West, like Western radio stations, which it was illegal to listen to, but we did it anyway, and news from the Western world, all we had access to was the communist countries, like Poland, Czechoslovakia, Hungary. We could go there, but we could never go to the West or to America, so that attracted me to coming here.
What kind of stuff was playing on the stations that you weren't supposed to be listening to?
Oh, my first fave when I got my first radio was in 1952, and my first fave was Harry Belafonte. With daylight coming, I want to go home. All those songs on his first album, I just love. And then listening to Radio Luxembourg, you heard all the latest hits. They had a hit parade once a week and played all the latest hits. And I learned about rock and roll. But I also learned a little bit about jazz and about Louis Armstrong and Ella Fitzgerald.
Well, I know that you were able to get out not until you were 18 years old, because there was a problem with refugees who were considered kids in refugee camps. But when you finally did get out, that was how you ended up in Detroit and in Michigan, was to go to school. There's something that I wondered about that I haven't seen written about very much. Were you able to see your family at all after you left?
Well, I left in 58, and in 1963, I was able to go back home and visit. I went to see my family that I had left behind, stayed in East Germany for 10 days and was able to leave. There was no problem with being captured. But I did go back in 1970 for the funeral of my mom. And I didn't have money to go then, but our friend Russ Gibb, who owned the Grandy Ballroom, was kind enough to pay for my airfare to Germany, along with my just born second daughter, Celia. She was only a month old when my mom died, so she had to come with me. She was part of me, so we went over there and buried my mom. And thanks to Russ Gibb, I was able to do that.
It's such a different time now. I think people forget just how rare travel was back in the day.
Oh, and it was so, yes, it was so exceptional to go to an airport. You had to dress up.
I think it would be now too, you know?
Well, yes.
You came to Detroit, like I said, and enrolled in school, and you met John Sinclair, and you and John were jazz people. When you ultimately started getting into jazz clubs and going with him to shows, was the jazz scene in Detroit much like you thought it would be?
Oh, no. When I first came to Detroit, I was really disappointed because I thought there was going to be jazz on every street corner. It was record studios all over the place. But it took a while for me because I was only 19 and I couldn't go to any clubs because you had to be 21. But I did befriend a jazz musician early on. It was Jack Brokenshaw, and he was a member of the Australian Jazz Quintet, and he had a radio station and a radio show in Detroit playing jazz. And I listened to it and then called, and in my limited English, I explained to him how much I liked his show, and he invited me to the station. You know, coming from Germany, I thought a radio station was this huge building. And then it was just a small room in the Maccabees building.
It's almost always less impressive than people think, yeah. Is there a story to how it was you came to Detroit in the first place? You were so enamored with jazz, I would have guessed a first choice would have been Chicago or New York.
No, I had no choice. Reason I came and settled in Detroit is because the sponsors for my citizenship, my cousin was a sponsor. Actually, one of my cousin's husband became my sponsor for immigration. And after being in the United States for 5 years, I made citizenship and became a citizen. I did not become a citizen by marrying an American, no. Even though the police thought I did, and they were trying to deport me because I married a very bad citizen, John Sinclair. They had it out for him from the beginning.
It was during this time that you started taking the pictures that we know you so well for. Pictures of jazz artists, for sure, but also just pictures of the city and the people that you were seeing on the streets. Aside from the music photos, which are very well known, were there things that you were seeing in Detroit that really struck you?
When I first came here, my cousins took me on rides to see the city and drove up and down Hastings Street. I got a little taste of what it used to be like, but that didn't last for very long. But I wasn't, I started taking pictures when I started to become active at Wayne State University at the student government, and I started pictures of demonstrations and I started pictures of people in SDS. In fact, at the time, I think I didn't really know, but there was another person in Detroit who was a member of early SDS, and there was Peter Wilby, who started the Fifth Estate later on.
Mm-hmm. But, the famous alternative paper, yeah.
Yes, yes. And because of me being an SDS, I got to observe people in action like Tom Hayden, Bob Ross, and other people. And I also got to go as a delegate to the National Student Association Conference in Bloomington, Indiana in 63. And that's where I met Stokely Carmichael and hung out with people in SNCC and SDS. And on August 28th, we all traveled to Washington to be part of the March on Washington. And I took pictures. Some of those pictures are in the exhibit now. The exhibit at MOCAT concentrates more on my life. Besides my pictures of musicians, they wanted pictures of my other kind of life besides taking pictures of musicians. So there's a lot of political pictures there.
If you're just joining us, my guest is photographer and activist Lenny Sinclair. We'll have more of our conversation in just a minute. Stay with us. This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. We're talking today with Lenny Sinclair, the photographer and activist whose work featured numerous famous Detroit musicians and scenes from political movements of the 1960s in Southeast Michigan. Her work is featured in Motor City Underground, a new exhibition at MOCAD in Detroit. I don't think we talk enough, and I guess by that I mean we civilians who don't take photos professionally. I don't think we talk enough about how two photographers can go to one show or one rally and come back with completely different photos of what was happening. Is there a way to describe the kinds of things that caught your eye or that you were looking for or looking to capture, maybe at rallies in the movement?
Well, you know, I was always looking for an interesting picture, for something that would be interesting to keep and to look at. And remember what it was like. And, you know, a lot of it, I just took pictures for myself and photographed those things I found interesting to have a memory and to have something to show for what I did. That was me wanting to document things that I was part of. But coming from another country, I have maybe a different outlook on what was happening in America, because I looked at it with through foreign eyes. I was in it, but I was not of it. So I took pictures, and my job designation would be called a participant observer. I was a participant observing at the same time. So that's how I ended up with a lot of interesting photographs, because I was involved in a lot of interesting different movements and groups.
As you mentioned, this was a time of just almost constant political activity. You and your husband, John, were doing so much through SDS. You had founded Detroit Artists Workshop, which was both supporting artists in their careers in a way, but also it was a platform for artists' response to the times. And reading, and also John was having, as you say, huge problems with the police who kept trying to bust him for marijuana charges. It's so crazy, you know, reading about all that now and thinking how quickly things changed when Michigan finally legalized. That's got to feel strange to you.
It is very strange. Now that it's legal, it's just like going to buy some groceries in a grocery store. You can go anywhere or have it delivered. But it also points out to me that the prohibition against marijuana was one of the biggest fake news stories since the 30s, when they made marijuana illegal for no reason other than not because it was dangerous, but the people who smoked it were considered dangerous, like jazz musicians, poets, beatniks, Mexicans. Anyway, that's what the police in America used to harass people that they didn't like. Because here in America, you couldn't arrest somebody because they were talking bad about the government. We have freedom of speech in America, supposedly. And so they used the marijuana laws to arrest people that they considered undesirables or criminals or junkies. And I think by making marijuana illegal and considering marijuana the worst drugs, just as bad as heroin, that they did a disservice to millions of people, that they got miseducated and caused the so-called war on drugs. It was the war on marijuana smokers, but it was not a war on drugs. It was the war against the people. So now it's all different, but it's still kind of disappointing that now that it's just a commodity like alcohol or like gambling, that it's just another way that the rich get richer and the poor people spend their money to make the rich get richer. That's how I think of it. Because the people who have been in the business of trying to expose a lie that marijuana prohibition was, we don't get nothing out of it. I feel like when I walk by a fancy dispensary with expensive medicines, expensive concentrates, expensive flowers, I think of myself as the one-eyed cat looking in the seafood store.
Wait,
I don't get nothing out of having fought since 1964 for the legalization, and now it's here, and now it's a rich man's game.
Lenny, wait a minute. This from the woman who got John Lennon and Yoko Ono to come to play the concert to free John Sinclair? That makes me so sad.
It is a little sad, but on the other hand, the uptick from it is that nobody's going to jail anymore for smoking a joint. I hope not. Other countries are still far behind America in that, like for instance, in Germany, it's still highly illegal. If you get caught, they take your car away, all kinds of things. And in lots of countries, they still put you in jail for smoking or for having it. We're a little bit better off than we used to be, yes.
You knew so many people who went to jail for their political beliefs, people who were involved in one way or another with Detroit Artists Workshop and Trans Love Energies Unlimited, which was sort of an outcropping of that. You were one of the founders of the White Panther Party and worked so closely with people who were in the Black Panthers and SDS. The lens that you developed during that time for looking at politics and looking at race and looking for how activists were meeting the challenges of the time, what did that do for your perception of what's been happening in this country over the past maybe 5 years with Black Lives Matter and other things that have brought people in Detroit to the streets?
Well, the most important thing about the Black Lives Matter movement to me was finally, it's an integrated movement. It's not Black people fighting for their rights. It's the whole country, young people in the whole country, getting together and marching and exposing police brutality and you know what's been happening to Black folks forever since they came were brought to this country in chains. So maybe a great part of the white population in this country is finally waking up that things must change, that there has to be, you know, reparations, something like that to bring things, to make the population more even and not have the white people own everything and the Black people work for the ones that own everything. That has to change. Call it socialism if you have to, but it's a class struggle, and it's a struggle for equal rights.
Yeah. I know you have a granddaughter, a school age granddaughter. What do you tell her about what's happening politically in the country right now?
I don't have to tell her anything. She's very aware and very much aware of what's happening in this country, and she listens to the news, she goes to college, she reads, and I have no fear of the future because it's got kids like that, and it's got millions of kids like that who know what is happening, and they will be inheriting the earth, and so we can help a little bit in education. Educating them about the past will help prepare them for the next struggle to come.
If you're just joining us, my guest is photographer Lenny Sinclair. A new exhibition of her work is going to be on view at MOCAD Detroit through April 18th. Well, let's talk a little bit about the show. This is your first solo show since, I want to say, 2014. You've said you were asked to think about some images that focus less on music photography and more just scenes from your life. How did you sit down? I know you have a lot of photographs and a lot of things that no one's ever seen. How did you decide what to pull together for this?
I didn't. I have to confess, it really was not my project to do this. But the people at MOCAD who are putting on the show, who are organizing the show for me, they looked through thousands of images that are on a hard drive, and they kind of suggested what they would like to display. And they were more interested in showing a side of me that people normally don't get to see, and that's my pictures of movements or involving in activities that are, they're not my music pictures, they're not my rock and roll pictures or my jazz pictures. In fact, at the same time as at MOCAD, I'm part of a show at a gallery, Camille, which is on Cass and Willis, and that features mostly my photos of musicians. And I'm part of a three-man or three-person show. There's two other photographers who have a much different style and very interesting photography subject and technique.
Were there any pictures that you were surprised that they'd selected?
No, just in general, I'm surprised that they selected all these pictures that I never thought I would have any that. Well, it's not the kind of pictures that I can make money with, because nobody wants to buy a picture of a police. but it's glad because it's good, because MOCAD is not dependent on selling these pictures and making money, because my show at MOCAD was... there was a number of organizations and foundations that helped financially with bringing this about, and for helping MOCAD. So I'm getting a lot of support that I had never thought of, that these people would help me get my pictures out to the public. But that's what's happening now, and I'm so grateful.
There's one photo that I really love in the show called Two Boys at the State Fairgrounds. I don't know if you remember exactly when this picture was taken and what was going on, but it's a photo that it shows like some little tiny shacks. I can't really tell if they were, you know, sort of temporary housing, very small. And then there's these boys standing out in front of them and some firefighters milling around in the background. It looks like there's been a fire, and in the way that people do, folks came out just to watch the firefighters do their work. And the boys are just kind of, they look like they're joking around with each other.
Yes, having fun, but I don't recall when I took the pictures, and I don't recall what that fire was for. In retrospect, I think that it may have been the fire set intentionally as a for the firefighters to learn how to put out a fire, because it doesn't seem to me a dangerous fire. It seems like a fire set for training purposes. But I could be wrong. I don't recall. It was all so long ago.
There's another amazing photo of Wayne Kramer of the MC5, of course, and he's standing with his back to the camera, and he's got a guitar slung across his back. And he also has a rifle slung across his back there, sort of crossways with the guitar. Could you talk about staging that one?
Well, yes. Being the in-house photographer for the MC5, so to speak, in-house meaning we actually lived in the same house for a while. I was always trying to get a photograph of the band that could be used for publicity, that would help get better gigs. And so we staged some publicity photographs in 69. And by that time, we had become White Panthers, and we thought of ourselves as, we better get ready for, if we were attacked, we had to be ready for self-defense. And so some of us acquired some rifles. But as far as I know, the MC5, they never shot them. They were used as photo pops. They were used as to make interesting looking pictures. Even myself, at the time, I went to Source and Roebuck and bought a .45, a little revolver, and never had a chance to even try it out when somebody who was crashing at our house, they stole it. But that was the sign of the times back then, that we thought we had to get ready for self-defense and we should be armed. But as far as I know, the MC5, they just played around with guns, you know. They just,
yeah,
use them for photo ops. That's how I looked at it. It's an interesting picture, but it's not dangerous.
His posture is one of the things that makes this photo so great to me. He's raising a fist, a power salute, and he's standing in front of this ginormous American flag. And it's very casual, and it's got some motion to it, but it just seems very, very Wayne Kramer.
Yes, it does. He does take good pictures, yes, from the front and from the back.
Are you still shooting?
Well, that's not very much, but I do take pictures with my iPhone when I see something I want to hang on to, and I have a camera, but I really don't have much time to go take pictures. My life is just really tied up with the pictures I have already taken, and there's just too many. And a lot of times, why should I take any more pictures? I don't know what to do with all the ones I already have. But still, right now, during the pandemic, you don't want to go out among people anyway and take pictures, no.
Are you staying safe? You know we can't, you know we can't do without you, right?
Oh, I don't know what that means. I'll not always be here. But right now, my two daughters are here staying with me and helping out a lot, doing the shopping for me. And they're mostly here in Detroit in order to help take care of my ex-husband. John Sinclair is not doing too well. He had a heart attack. He's recuperating. but he needs his daughter's help almost every day. We're doing okay. So far, so good.
Photographer Lenny Sinclair's work, collected in a show called Motor City Underground, can be seen at MOCAD, Museum of Contemporary Art Detroit, through April 18th. Lenny, thank you so much for your time.
Well, thank you. Okay. Take care.
I'm April Baer. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next week.